to Strictly Business, the podcast in which we speak with some of the brightest minds working in the media business today. I'm Andrew Wallenstein with Variety. Roku is on a roll. Its stock price grew about 150% in 2020, and the streaming platform shows no signs of cooling down this year, thanks to some interesting deals getting done in recent months, from finally securing the HBO Max app to its licensing of the Quibi content catalog. Yes, you heard that right, Quibi. So, who better to talk to than the man who got those deals done at Roku, its senior VP of the platform business, Scott Rosenberg. I got to speak with Scott on January 14th at the Variety Entertainment Summit, a CES partner program. We'll have this special interview coming up in just a moment. Back to the Strictly Business podcast, where I'm joined today by Scott Rosenberg, Senior VP of the platform business at Roku. Scott, I just want to start with some data points from our Variety Intelligence platform that show just how incredible the growth story at Roku has been. Clearly, you guys have been on the rise in a number of key metrics for years now, but when you look at the last 12 months, it's especially impressive. You've added over 10 million subscribers over the last four quarters, over 6 billion hours of streaming hours over the same period. No wonder you're the leader in the connected TV space as you go up against some much bigger competitors. And look, I've got my theories as to how things are going so well for you, but I want to hear it from you. What are you guys getting right in 2020? It seems like you're hitting all cylinders.
Yeah, thanks for the setup, Andy. I appreciate it, and for having us on. 2020 was an amazing year for Roku. As you said, we cleared 50 million active accounts, which is our proxy for households. We had 55% growth in streaming hours. That's our measure of user engagement. We're the number one TV in the U.S. 38% of all smart TVs sold in the U.S. were powered by the Roku operating system. We're number one in Canada as well. You know, I'd attribute this to really two factors. One is, this is a secular transition. All television is going to be streamed. Everybody's going to leave the traditional pay TV package. That was a trend that was well underway before the pandemic. But the pandemic really accelerated the transition. And that really owes to the drying up of live sports and news. So the pay TV package just wasn't as attractive to the consumers who were still in the pay TV package. And it really created the incentive for consumers to cut the cord. About a third of US households have now cut the cord. Among our universe, 92% of Roku consumers who've cut the cord have said that they're very satisfied and they're not going back. So the pandemic really pulled forward, accelerated a bunch of change that was already well underway. And Roku's done well because of our product offerings, because we keep the user experience simple and intuitive. It's a great content lineup, and the value equation's really there. You know, you can get into a Roku streaming stick for $29, or you can get an incredible 65-inch television with Roku built in.
But as you referenced, clearly the pandemic had its impact with this shelter-at-home audience that was just sort of tailor-made for Roku. You've also got a lot of streaming services coming online in 2020. I assume you saw a lot of sampling, and Roku was right there for a lot of these new players.
Yeah, 2020 was a great year for consumers. You know, you had Disney Plus launch in late 2019. You had Peacock, you had HBO Max launch. Just last week, we had Discovery Plus launch. All of these services are distinct, they're unique, but they all buoy the proposition for consumers to cut the cord and move to streaming. And you know, that's also a benefit that accrues to a platform like Roku. As the experience gets richer, as the content gets richer, consumers move more of their TV time to our devices. And that's ultimately our goal. Our strategy is to capture more households, but also more time in our households.
You seem pretty sure, though, about, you know, mass cord cutting. And I got to say, I wonder, during the pandemic, we actually saw some of those numbers slow a bit as live TV came online. I mean, do you really think it's going to be quite the free fall that some make it out to be?
I do. And I think it depends, I guess, on your definition of free fall. I would call double digit ratings declines year over year for many years in a row free fall. We did see when sports came back, we saw some users who had switched to streaming go back, but they actually didn't restore 100% of their linear viewership at when sports came back. So you have dynamics like that where consumers just don't return back to where they were. I think in another area in theatrical releases, you've got folks like Warner experimenting during the pandemic by bringing 17 titles to HBO Max. You've got Disney doing Mulan and a bunch of other titles. I think the question will be coming out of the pandemic is, does day and date movie experiences, does that last after the pandemic? Do consumers get used to it and demand it and really enjoy it as an experience? Do studios and distributors get comfortable with it as a new distribution model? We'll see, but consumers are the winners here. And I think they set up a precedent and a pressure to support some of these new consumption models.
Well, speaking of pressure, I got to wonder whether Roku is somewhat like Netflix, which also obviously had a gangbuster 2020, but kind of already warned the street like, hey, don't expect 2021 to be like this. Do you guys feel 21 is going to be a tough act to follow simply because 20 was such a unique set of circumstances?
Well, I won't comment on the future too much, except to say that I still think that there's an enormous amount of television consumption, even in a more mature market like the States, that still has to move to streaming. You look at the breadth of content that's available, but still coming to streaming. Then you look abroad, you look internationally, where streaming is not as far along as the States are. I think that OTT streaming is still a young market with lots of long-term potential growth.
Let's talk a bit about that long-term potential. I mean, how do you see the TV advertising market changing in the next 5 years, given connected TV seemed to had a real breakthrough in 2020?
Well, I do think that television marketers are coming to grips with the fact that they just can't reach all TV households anymore. When a third of US households have cut the cord, a traditional pay TV investment program by an ad agency isn't going to reach a third of TV households. So that's the first big step, I think, for TV marketers as they think about streaming, is just to keep reaching TV viewers while they're on the new experience. Over time, though, what'll play out is just that streaming advertising is a better mousetrap than traditional linear television. I think consumers expect a better ad experience. They aren't going to tolerate ad infinitum, 15, 16 minutes on the hour of untargeted ads. So there's that consumer pressure. But for marketers who've grown to expect their media to get smarter, to be more targetable, to be more measurable, to be able to optimize to a site visit or a product purchase, streaming also offers those capabilities. And so I think it's both a push and a pull that's going to ultimately cause yet more budgets to move out of traditional television into streaming.
I think what people really began to understand about your business in 2020 was the so-called, date you brought to the dance was the device business and getting into TV operating systems. But that was really just kind of a prelude to a focus on ad monetization. And I think that's really what's driven the growth here. But is this market mature enough yet? I mean, you're obviously very bullish on it, but there, at least in 2020, it feels like there's still a ways to go for connected TV to truly be superior.
Well, I'm biased, of course. I think from a consumer experience perspective, it's already superior. Is it yet commanding the kind of dollars and investment commensurate with the consumer viewership that's already taking place? The answer to that is not yet. And I think we'll see that start to continue to play out over time. You know, Roku last 12 months had an ARPU, a revenue per user, of about $27, which has been growing healthily along with strong consumer growth. But that $27 is still a very modest portion of what a US TV household is worth in terms of what they pay for services and the value of the advertising that they experience. So I think that shows you just how young the streaming market is and how significant the upside potential is that's out there. In terms of your reference to our business model, our goal has always been to be in a devices business. That's the yin part of our business, but it's not a particularly profitable part of the business. It's a user acquisition vehicle. The yang here is the services, the economics that we derive after you take your Roku home and set it up. And as you point out, that's been heavily about advertising. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is advertising funds about one of every $2 that funds the overall TV ecosystem today. The other dollar coming from what consumers pay their pay TV provider. It's also because Roku as a platform has a unique value add for marketers who are looking to move their dollars. We have a direct relationship with our consumers. We have lots of bespoke ad experiences that we can create for brands. It puts us in a unique position to help brands migrate out of traditional television.
Got it. You mentioned HBO Max earlier, which was probably a big growth driver in the last month of the year with all those movies, first run, 30-day windows. But it took months and months for HBO Max to finally show up on Roku after pretty protracted negotiations. Is it fair to say that you finally gave HBO Max access to Roku subs because Warner basically leveraged that movie move and you couldn't have possibly afford to not have them on the platform?
Well, I won't comment in too much detail on those negotiations. We're very glad to have gotten a deal done, as I think they are as well. Both parties had a lot to offer. Roku with 50 million active accounts is a pretty important platform partner for any service in streaming. But as you point out, HBO Max is a great service, great movies coming. I watched Wonder Woman on the 24th or 25th with my two teenage kids. You know, these deals sometimes take longer, but ultimately our goal is to create value for the partners. And these distribution partnerships are different from a traditional cable TV programmer carriage dispute in that those disputes are almost always about a fixed and declining pie, where the parties are really trying to preserve economics in a declining ecosystem. OTT is totally different. It's up and to the right. And so the trick in these deals is to create a win-win relationship with a partner like WarnerMedia, where when they win, Roku wins, and of course the consumer wins by getting the service live. We did it with them. We got Discovery Plus live last week. We got Peacock live. We're really excited about these services.
But you make that comparison that I think a lot of people were making to sort of the cable business and these blackout battles that are all too common. And you know, what does Hollywood need to know about Roku's negotiation stance? Is this going to be, are we going to see a lot more of this, or has Hollywood, the content companies, come around to better understanding where Roku is after a few really high publicized tussles?
Well, I think, by the way, what made those higher profiles, just the industry hadn't seen them before. So it's a new thing. I mean, like, I think it's all our jobs to put these services and great content in front of the consumer. And it's particularly our job as a distribution platform to serve up to our consumers what they want to watch. So, I don't have any particular messages for our partners. We look for, you know, win-win deals where Roku gets a share of the economics, typically in the subscription service, if it's a paid service, and a share of economics in the advertising side. But our job as Roku is to drive the success of these services. If Discovery Plus goes live on Roku and isn't successful, nobody wins. Not Discovery, not Roku, not the consumer. And that's ultimately our DNA as a company, is to get into distribution mode, partner deeply with these content providers, and make sure that they get a lot of traction.
I mean, there are several things you're trying to get as you make these deals. There's subscription revenue, advertising revenue, data. What has been the bigger sticking point as you negotiate these deals? Is there one area where it's like, you know, the content companies just don't seem to understand what Roku needs?
What we agree or disagree on really depends on the partner. Advertising can be more contentious, but I think that's also because this part of the business is somewhat distinct and evolving quickly relative to traditional television. You know, in traditional television, a programmer and an MVPD would split 2 minutes on the hour to the MVPD, and it's a clean split. OTT, streaming ad tech, looks a lot more like digital. And so how the ad tech works is a lot more complicated. Just the plumbing of how two parties collaborate on things like ad insertion and targeting and measurement is more complicated. So sometimes that's a rub, but there again, I just think the upside is huge. We're really at the precipice of reinventing how TV advertising is going to work for the next couple of decades. And there's huge value creation potential. And we as a platform have great tools that we can provide to our programming partners as they move their ad sales into this more advanced phase of TV advertising.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more from Scott Rosenberg. We're back with Scott Rosenberg, Senior VP of the Platform Business at Roku.
Another high-profile deal that got you guys some attention recently was with Quibi, which, yeah, you know, you licensed their content from their now-defunct app. We haven't seen this kind of content grab from Roku before, so it begs the question, is this the beginning of a new phase, the first of many such deals, or more of an experimental one-off?
I would say neither, but just to speak on behalf of Quibi, we thought from the time the service launched that it would do well in connected TV. It wasn't part of their launch strategy. So it became an opportunity, of course, towards the end of last year, and we jumped on it. It's 75 plus shows, hundreds of hours, 10 Emmy nominations, two wins for Free Rayshon, and just an awesome who's who of talent in these shows. Some of it's on the more experimental end. Some of it is just, you could see it having been produced for the 10-foot environment from the first place. So for us, it's an exciting opportunity to put amazing content into the Roku channel, which has grown very, very quickly for Roku. And it's a chance to put this great content in an AVOD, in an ad-supported business model. Of course, Quibi was a subscription-based service. And so we think both the combination of Roku scale and the scale of Roku channel, plus the caliber of content, bodes very well for the Quibi library. It's going to do great.
Well, but before I ask you more about the Roku channel, I mean, it sounds like you're making the assumption that, you know, with Quibi, this was good content locked up in a not quite right for the marketplace vehicle, whose problems had nothing to do with the content. But doesn't it give you some pause? Isn't it possible that Quibi failed because of the content?
I suppose, but we don't think that's the case. Most of the content actually never saw the light of day. We've got a couple dozen shows that will premiere on Roku. They were part of a staged rollout by Quibi. So I really don't think it's about the content. It might've been about how it was presented. I mean, of course, launching a service like that in the middle of the pandemic was an unfortunate timing for them. We think the content's going to do great. It's a lot of fun. I mean, the shows are really fun, really broad spectrum. They'll appeal to younger users. We think they'll resonate very strongly with adults 18 to 34, which is a key demographic for anybody in the ad business. We're excited.
And I get that. But it also sounds like you're stopping short of saying, and this is the beginning of a shopping spree. We are now the big buyer. All the agencies come on in, which I got to ask, like, so why aren't you guys going on some big spree? Because you could argue what makes the most sense to grow the Roku channel is for you to load up like you're the next Netflix or Disney Plus.
Well, I won't comment on into the future too much, except to say that the Roku channel has grown very significantly over time. It more than doubled last year. It's a top 10 channel on the platform in terms of reach and hours, 40,000 titles, 150 live linear channels. We have shown over time our ability to invest more, put a greater breadth and depth of content into the Roku channel. And the acquisition of Quibi is another step in that process. We will continue to invest. There's still a lot more viewership and great content to put into the Roku channel, but it's not a signal of a giant spending spree, as you said.
Got it. Well, you of course still play host to a lot of the streaming services that are on various kinds of spending sprees. And I'm just curious to get your perspective as, you know, going back all the way from Netflix to now Discovery Plus and soon Paramount Plus and who knows how many more pluses. Do you guys have a take in terms of how you see the so-called streaming wars playing out? Because I refuse to believe, for one, that it's just going to be, oh, sure, there'll be anywhere from 10 to 15 different multi-billion dollar, completely separate streaming services out there. But maybe you see different. What do you see?
Well, I mean, I do agree with what you're hinting at, which is that the average consumer does have some basic capacity in their household to pay for television. It's also our view that that's almost certainly lower than what it's been in pay TV. Most consumers, you know, in addition to a better user experience, are looking for some savings as they cut the cord and move to streaming. So there is some capacity. I don't think we know what it is yet. Is it three services? Is it five? Is it seven? But it's probably not 10 or 12 services. And so that suggests that they're in any given market, in any given territory, there can only be a certain number of scaled up services. I don't think that precludes niche services. One of the things about streaming is it, like the internet, it allows all shapes and sizes to coexist at the same time. But in terms of the Disneys, the Netflixes, the Amazons and their capacity to invest, I think there'll be a finite number in any given market. More importantly, though, in terms of the Roku channel and things like our Quibi deal, is there is a massive amount of content being produced and available on the shelves from historic productions. And not all of that content's going to fit within the strategy or brand of the set of big streaming services that land on your home screen. Where does that content live? How does a consumer find it? Where does it get aggregated? That's ultimately, in our view, the opportunity for something like the Roku channel. There is great content out there owned by entities that are not trying to be Disney Plus, not trying to be Peacock, but who still want to monetize that content, get it in front of consumers. And that's where a service like the Roku channel can play a valuable role, surfacing that content outside of one of the set of apps that the consumer has downloaded and subscribed to.
So you're referencing the ton of niche services out there, anyone from, you know, AMC to BritBox to all those, you know, does Roku channel ultimately perhaps solve the content discovery problem out there, where there's just too many, you know, too many ports of call where content resides, and Roku channel sort of represents a consolidation of that?
Yeah, I think so. And any big service that's going to house a lot of content needs to be an expert at personalization, at machine learning, because once you house in the Roku channel, it's like 40,000 titles, then it's another 50 or 70,000 when you count the premium services like HBO and Showtime, others that have been available. You need to layer on machine learning, recommendations, technology, just to help the consumer get through that content and find something that they want to watch, to pick up something that they were previously watching. So that's a big focus for us at Roku, is using technologies to help consumers discover and get back into a video viewing session faster.
It sounds like 2021 is going to be just as interesting a year for you guys as 2020 was. I wish you the very best, and looking forward to seeing how you do. Thanks for your time, Scott.
Yep, thank you. Nice chatting.
This has been another episode of Strictly Business. Tune in next week for another helping of scintillating conversation with media movers and shakers. And please make sure you subscribe to the podcast to hear future episodes. Also, leave a review in Apple Podcasts and let us know how we're doing.